Good morning and welcome. My name is Kelly Lang and I'm an assistant adjunct professor of bioethics and medical humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin. I will be the session's moderator and timekeeper. Today we are going to be talking about the increasing prevalence of a legislated role for ethics committees in healthcare decision making. Our session is divided into four sections, one for each panelist, and then a full 20 minutes for discussion. We're going to ask that you hold questions until the end so we can get through each of the topics. I'll introduce each panelist and their topic and then we'll get started. We will begin with Thaddeus Pope, who is an associate professor of law at Widener University School of Law, where he teaches health law and bioethics. He is also an adjunct associate professor at Albany Medical College. In January, Thaddeus will join those of us here in the Midwest when he relocates to the Twin Cities as the director of the Health Law Institute at Hamline University. Thad will begin our session by providing us with a framework to consider how state laws empower hospital ethics committees with some authority. Our next panelist will be Dr. Hannah Lippman, who is an associate professor of medicine specializing in geriatrics and cardiology at Montefiore. She is also the associate director of the Montefiore Einstein Center for Bioethics and chief of the Bioethics Consultation Service. Hannah serves as co-chair of the system-wide work group charged with implementing New York's Family Healthcare Decisions Act. She will talk about New York's law in some detail and share her experience as a physician at the bedside with this legislation. And our third panelist, Anita Tarzian, is an associate professor of nursing at the University of Maryland and the program coordinator for the Maryland Healthcare Ethics Committee Network at the University of Maryland School of Law. She is chair of ASBH's Clinical Ethics Consultation Affairs Standing Committee and yesterday was recognized with ASBH's Distinguished Service Award. Congratulations again, Anita. She will discuss some specific aspects of Maryland's legislation and will examine the value of ethics committee review and competency of committee members to serve in the state-mandated role.
All right. Good morning. Okay, so what I'm going to do is synthesize and summarize state law that delegate power to ethics committees. But first, what I want to do is provide some context for that. The antecedents of today's ethics committees date to the 1950s and especially to the 1960s. And these committees to which I'm referring served not in a merely advisory capacity, but they served as gatekeepers and as decision makers. Just three quick examples. Before Roe versus Wade, therapeutic abortion committees were a key gatekeeper permitting access to abortion. And before Medicare coverage in 1972, dialysis allocation committees served a gatekeeping role permitting access to dialysis. And IRBs, of course, make decisions about how and whether research with human subjects will proceed. But clinical ethics committees, as famously endorsed by Quinlan in 76 and by the President's Advisory Commission in 83, were conceived as advisory only. And you'll hear in a few minutes that in Maryland, you know, the committees are known as patient care advisory committees, so the very name and adjective, you know, emphasizes their voluntary elective nature. They facilitate communication but don't make decisions, much less binding ones. So in 1984, John Robertson described two dimensions along which to describe ethics committees. You know, first, it can be either optional or mandatory to consult or use the ethics committees, and that's indicated by the two rows. And second, it can be either optional or mandatory to follow the advice or recommendation of the ethics committee once consulted. Now, traditionally, ethics committees have been in box one here, right? Optional. You don't need to use them, and even if you do use it, you don't need to really follow what they say. You can consider it and ignore it if you want to. So that's, you know, traditionally box one. But increasingly, ethics committees have moved on to boxes 2, 3, and 4, where sometimes you must consult the ethics committee, and sometimes even when the ethics committee's recommendation or decision is binding. So I'm going to describe some state laws that give specific power to ethics committees, but first I want to note that even without official formal authority, that ethics committees still have significant power. And that's because even when ethics committees make decisions, even if it's not legally binding, it still has a practical effect of being binding. And there's three quick reasons for that. One is that patients and surrogates often perceive the ethics committee as authoritative. And, you know, if that's not true, they often lack the resources to challenge the ethics committee in any case. And third, even if they had the resources to challenge the ethics committee, they often wouldn't or don't, because it's widely recognized that courts would likely defer to the supposed expertise of the ethics committee. So two quick examples on that. One, which was mentioned on Friday, is a lawsuit filed in Montreal by the parents of a severely disabled girl, Phoebe Mantha, and the parents, at the recommendation of the providers, decided to take her off life support. The providers agreed, but the ethics committee did not agree, and the parents reluctantly acceded to the ethics committee, but only because they thought that they had to, right? They perceived it as, you know, as authoritative. And so actually the lawsuit that was filed, the complaint, specifically challenges the hospital's failure to disclose the ethics committee's merely advisory status. And another example would just be the Ashley X case, where neither the providers nor the family sought a court order for Ashley's sterilization, as required by Washington state law, because they thought that the ethics committee's stamp of approval was by itself sufficient. So that's de facto power. So let me turn to de jure power, right? In some states, state laws give ethics committee certain roles and powers. In Hawaii, for example, the very statutory definition of an ethics committee is to make decisions regarding ethical questions, including life-sustaining therapy. Other states give ethics committees more narrowly defined roles, and I think these can be sorted into two categories. There's a role as adjudicator and a role as gatekeeper. As adjudicator, ethics committees decide different types of disputes, but I only have time. I'll talk about futility disputes and surrogate disputes. And when it comes to adjudicating futility disputes, the paradigm example is Texas, where the Texas Advanced Directives Act tells providers that you may stop life-sustaining treatment for any reason, even without surrogate consent, as long as your ethics committee agrees with you. And the ethics committee and the providers that follow the recommendation of the ethics committee have legal immunity as long as they provide a certain amount of minimum notice to the surrogate. Moreover, the ethics committee in Texas is the form of last resort. Its decision cannot be challenged. It cannot be reviewed in court. Now, because of legal requirements or because of legal uncertainty, providers in other states usually cave in to what they think are inappropriate surrogate demands. So there's been significant interest in a lot of these other states in copying the Texas law, empowering ethics committees in futility disputes. Okay, so the second decision-making role that state law gives ethics committees is to adjudicate surrogate disputes, right? And we all know that there's been little effective advanced care planning in the United States. So most surrogates are not appointed by the patient, but they're chosen off the state statutory priority default list that usually looks something like this. Not exactly, but often something pretty much like this. Now, sometimes, though, there's conflict between two surrogates of the same class, right? Two daughters, brother and a sister, two daughters. And in some states, like Maryland and Delaware, the ethics committee can determine who is the appropriate surrogate. And then the provider has immunity for following the ethics committee decision, deciding who among the two surrogates of the same class is the appropriate surrogate. So here, you know, these are just deciding futility disputes and surrogate disputes. In addition to a dispute resolution role, the ethics committees also serve, or are being delegated by state law, a gatekeeping or checkpointing role. So two examples here are the unbefriended patients and then certain categories of life-sustaining treatment decisions. And there's others, but we don't have time. So with respect to the unbefriended patients without proxies, many states let the attending physician make treatment decisions on the patient's behalf, But so long as the ethics committee agrees. So it's the ethics committee approval, in a sense, substitutes what would be what would otherwise be the mechanism, which would be getting a court-appointed guardian to give consent. A new law in Oregon from just a few months ago permits a hospital to appoint an ethics committee to give informed consent to medically necessary health care services. Ethics committees also serve a gatekeeping role for certain life-sustaining treatment decisions, and Dr. Lippman in a moment will give a few examples from New York. So let me give you a different example. This is Haley Putre. In 2005, she was hospitalized with severe brain injuries after being abused by her stepfather. The Massachusetts Department of Social Services assumed custody and then moved to terminate Haley's life support after physicians declared that she was in a persistent vegetative state. But Putri's condition then improved. She could breathe on her own and follow simple commands. And this was pretty embarrassing for the state and continues to present political problems for Mitt Romney. So to provide a safeguard against future errors, a new state statute in Massachusetts requires that the Massachusetts Department of Social Services obtain, before they withdraw for somebody in their care, they obtain the recommendation from the hospital ethics committees where the patient is. So in sum, state laws have been giving new roles to, including decision-making roles, to ethics committees, and you would expect that as they got more power and authority, the quality and integrity of the process would improve, that there'd be a positive correlation between due process and authority. But in fact, ethics committees have gotten more power along the horizontal axis here, but little seems to have changed by way of training and procedures. And there's a danger that ethics committees may get less respect from courts, less trust from the public. And charges have been raised, charging ethics committees as star chambers, as a black box, as a fig leaf, and as a rug, you know, under which, you know, you would sweep the tragic choices that we have to make. So I think my warning in the last 30 seconds here is to say that, you know, we have to make sure that the due process promised by ethics committee review doesn't become a mere illusion. And we have to work to mitigate for risks. Because as ethics committees do more, there's more risk of error. There's a risk of corruption because the ethics committee members are usually all insiders and there's a conflict of interest. A risk of carelessness, that the decisions are ill-considered and ill-supported, a risk of bias due to race and culture, and a risk of arbitrariness because they don't follow process norms such as giving sufficient notice. And this is my final warning is that, you know, if we don't do a good job at self-regulation, if you follow the path of the Motion Picture Association, right, then the regulation will be done for you. Thank you.
So I have a cold, so forgive the way I sound. It's not my real voice. Can you hear? It's working? Okay. So just raise your hand if you stop being able to hear me. So I see some New Yorkers in the audience, which is good. I look forward to a good discussion about this after all the presentations. So I'm going to talk about the New York State Family Healthcare Decisions Act, which is a law that went into effect last June. And the basic thing that it does is give surrogates the authority to make healthcare decisions for patients who lack capacity and have no healthcare agent. We actually didn't have a law in New York State that allowed families to even consent to major treatment, let alone talk about withdrawing or withholding life-sustaining treatment. So this law lays out a framework for both of those categories. It only applies in hospitals and nursing homes. And again, it distinguishes the decision-making framework for consenting to treatment and withholding and withdrawing life-sustaining treatment. It really represents a sea change in the way that the law looks at how families can make decisions about life-sustaining treatment. Before, in New York State, we had case law that dictated that a family member who was not a duly appointed healthcare proxy could only withdraw life-sustaining treatment if the decision was in accordance with clear and convincing evidence of the patient's wishes. And now, instead, the law conceives of clinical criteria which the patient must meet in order to empower a surrogate. Also, the law gives specific legal weight to patients' wishes. In fact, it says that a family surrogate need not even be consented for a particular decision if the patient has made that decision in the past and that decision by the patient is documented in a specific way. The law also establishes extremely strict criteria for decision-making for patients who have no surrogates, the patient alone, and lays out a way of making decisions to withhold and withdraw life-sustaining treatment in that context, but I'll show you the criteria. They're very strict. I wanted to give you sort of an overall picture of what the Family Healthcare Decisions Act does, because I think it helps understand why the Ethics Review Committee part of the law is set up the way it is. So it's important to note how the law conceives of protecting, I think, vulnerable patients. So again, because we're empowering families to make decisions when they haven't been appointed by the patient, the law seeks to provide a way of protecting patients from sort of run-amok authority by their surrogates. And it does that with clinical criteria that the patient must meet in order to empower surrogates. Again, this is not specifically related to the Ethics Review Committee, but it helps define what role the Ethics Review Committees were given, which I'll get to in a second. So the law lays out two different kinds of patients, patient who is either permanently unconscious or terminally ill. It says if you have a patient who's terminally ill or permanently unconscious and the treatment is considered extraordinarily burdensome, then okay, that's all right. We'll let family members make a decision to withdraw or withhold it. But it says, okay, it may be appropriate for families to make those sorts of decisions even if somebody doesn't meet the criteria of being terminally ill or permanently unconscious. And it says, okay, that patient has an incurable or irreversible illness, then the families may be able to withhold or withdraw that treatment, but only if the treatment involves such pain, suffering, or other burden that it would be reasonably deemed inhumane or extraordinarily burdensome. So it kind of really tightens up the language. It says, okay, maybe we have an advancing dementia patient who's still somewhat interactive, not terminally ill, not unconscious. And it's okay to say, have a do not intubate order for that, but you better consider that treatment that you're withholding as very burdensome. For patients alone, if we don't know their wishes, the criteria are even stricter. It says that treatment may be withheld or withdrawn if it offers no medical benefit, because the patient will die with or without it imminently, and provision of the treatment violates acceptable medical standards. I don't know why we would be providing treatment that violates acceptable medical standards, but again, it's a mechanism, but it's a very protective mechanism. The law presumes that if we don't know the patient's wishes, they're going to want to be kept alive under almost all circumstances, unless the treatment violates acceptable medical standards. So I just wanted to lay that out because it gives you a sense of how the law is conceiving of protecting vulnerable people. So the law specifies this ethics review committee mechanism. It's both a dispute resolution mechanism and a sort of ethics consultation mechanism with binding authority in certain circumstances, which I'll get to. But in its more general role as a dispute resolution mechanism, it's role is advisory. It's not required to be consulted. The law says that you can solve ethics dilemmas by less formal means, and following the Ethics Review Committee recommendations is not required. So the law specifies that it can help resolve disputes about capacity determination when life-sustaining treatment decisions are made in New York by anybody other than the patient. Requires two physicians to determine that the patient lacks capacity about that. So there could be disputes about whether the patient has capacity or not, about who the designated surrogate should be. We have a hierarchy much like that put up there. It could be over the decision itself. There could be two opinions are required. Two physician opinions are required to determine whether the patient meets those clinical criteria or whether the treatment recommendations are appropriate. And there could be disagreements among physicians about that. And it lays out similar things specifically regarding protection of minors and minors who may have capacity and disputes between minors and their parents. But there are three specific cases where an ethics review committee authority is binding, actually. And I wanted to go over those. So, again, it sort of gives us some insight into how the law is trying to protect vulnerable people. So I call them Category B patients. But Category B are those patients who are not terminally ill or permanently unconscious. They're the people who I conceive of as advancing dementia, advanced heart failure. So if a category B patient is in a nursing home and their family wants to make a decision other than a do not resuscitate order, say maybe not to put in a PEG tube or to forego intubation or to forego dialysis, that requires ethics committee review in a nursing home in New York State now. The surrogate only has authority if the ethics review committee reviews that decision and determines that it's in accordance with the standards. In the hospital setting, there are two instances where the ethics review committee opinion is binding. When a physician objects to a surrogate's decision to forego artificial nutrition and hydration for one of those category B patients. So it's interesting. A family could decide, the ethics review committee doesn't have the same role if somebody's terminally ill or permanently unconscious and the family wants to withhold artificial nutrition and hydration. But if the patient doesn't meet those criteria and is just irreversibly ill, then the physician objects to that, we don't have to review it if the physician agrees that that's appropriate. But an ethics committee must review it, and the artificial nutrition and hydration must be provided until the ethics committee reviews. And also, the last scenario is when an emancipated minor is deciding to forego life-sustaining treatment. So all foregoing life-sustaining treatment decisions by emancipated minors must be given a stamp of approval by the Ethics Review Committee. And the Ethics Review Committee's job in that setting is to determine that that decision meets the standards laid out for adults. It's interesting also to note what's not given to an ethics review committee in New York State. A couple of things came to my mind, and there are others I'm sure that are interesting, but one is sort of, quote, futility cases. The law doesn't use the word futility, but it does say that if a surrogate directs that treatment be provided, and that treatment would, without that treatment, the patient would die, and the physician doesn't think it's appropriate to provide that treatment. So that's, I think, a definition of a futility, one of the definitions of a futility case. The medical provider and hospital should give that treatment, should comply with the surrogate decision, pending transfer of the patient to another institution or judicial review. So it doesn't give the ethics committee a role to try and resolve that dispute. It doesn't mean that ethics consultation service can't be weigh in and try and do mediation and resolve that dispute with good communication, but it doesn't say that the ethics review committee can substitute for the court in that setting. It doesn't give the Ethics Review Committee the authority to act for patients alone. We're not a substitute surrogate. Those strict criteria for patients alone are what are there to protect them, and there's really no room given to say, well, just because we don't know what somebody wants doesn't mean that there's not a role to decide goals of care. But that's not in the law. We don't have a way of bringing together a plurality of voices to decide goals of care for a patient who's alone. Also, and this one is near and dear to my heart because it's one of the common reasons we get consulted in our consultation service, it doesn't give it doesn't give a role for treatment refusals by patients who lack capacity. The law says that if somebody is determined to lack capacity, but they disagree with that, they say, no, I'm going home. I don't care that you say I can't and that I can't decide. Which we get consulted on a lot, as I said. It says that you can't override a patient's decision even if they lack capacity without going to court. It doesn't give ethics a role there. It doesn't specifically give a role for adjudicating or mediating disputes between patients' prior wishes and the surrogate's current opinion about what should go on, which is another common reason my service gets consulted. It basically says if the patient's made this decision, you don't need consent from the surrogate. Like I said before, you have to notify them. I personally don't think it's good practice of medicine to say, I have a living will. It says your father should be terminally extubated, so come in Friday at 3 and we're going to do it, which is like meeting the minimum standard of the law. But the law very concretely says, oh, okay, you can enact the patient's wishes. It doesn't really recognize that you could have disputes about it, and it doesn't give formally the Ethics Review Committee a purview over that. Of course, we can still consult about it and advise. So it also determines how the Ethics Review Committee should be composed. At least 5 members, 3 health or social services practitioners, 1 doctor, 1 nurse, 1 person with no relationship to the hospital at all, which can be a very practical barrier. In a nursing home, all nursing homes are supposed to have ethics review committees. The residence council must be offered the opportunity to appoint up to 2 people, not a resident of the nursing home, not a family member of a resident. And specifically, it says somebody who's demonstrated a commitment to the care of the elderly and patients' rights in their activities other than a medical provider. So they really want the residents to be given an opportunity to name sort of a community leader of some sort. Of course, no person connected with the case, no physician taking care of the patient or a nurse taking care of the patient can serve on that ethics review committee. In terms of ethics review committee competence, the requirements to serve on an ethics review committee in New York is just a demonstrated, the person must have demonstrated an interest in or commitment to patients' rights or to the medical, public health, or social needs of those who are ill. So very, very broad and no specific standards. Some procedural things are outlined. They must consider and respond promptly to anything referred to them. It's still a matter up for debate whether somebody asks for an ethics review committee, if I can give them ethics consultation. I have a single, we practice primarily a single consultant model at Montefiore, so you're not going to get an ad hoc or a group process every time you get ethics consultation. But we must respond promptly and provide ethical advice, healthcare recommendations, and dispute mediation. And what's another interesting thing, which is Montefiore has been involved in trying to create a listserv of competent people, is that ethics review committees may be shared among institutions, which can really help if you need somebody who is going to be a valuable member of that committee but is not in your hospital. You need somebody who's not related to the hospital. Further procedures are laid out for those three particular scenarios where the Ethics Review Committee has binding authority. If you're not dealing with a binding authority case, the law is less concerned about your procedural standards. But if you are, it lays out more specifically that the committee must give notification to the patient and others involved that there is a pending case. They must be given information about the composition and function of the Ethics Review Committee, and the committee's response must be given in writing. And the person who, people involved in the case, including the patient and surrogate and any, and advisors, have the right to make a presentation to the Ethics Review Committee. The law also talks about confidentiality of medical records and how the proceedings of a Ethics Review Committee are not subject to disclosure and are not admissible as evidence. The law specifically says that the people serving on the Ethics Review Committee are immune from civil and criminal liability if they're acting in good faith. So at Montefiore, our responses have been a lot of policy developments, which I've been involved in. It's been very interesting. We've had to revamp all of our Do Not Resuscitate forms to comply with the law. And in fact, this whole Ethics Review Committee stuff has been secondary to the real sea change that I talked about in the beginning of what the law does. We have yet to convene one. But again, we've tried to facilitate a way of sharing Ethics Review Committee members among local institutions with a list of qualified professionals. So I just wanted to very quickly raise some questions that I thought about in terms of thinking about the implications of the law, and then we can have a much more rich discussion afterwards. So first question is, what should be the role of ethics in the institution? I found myself as co-chair of the work group implementing this as somebody who became an educator throughout the system about a law, and I'm not a lawyer. And I found myself having to say, this is an ethicist view of the law, or, you know, that kind of thing. Developing policies and explaining policies. Of course, it's led to more ethics consultations, though, which is a good thing. We've had issues sort of thinking about how to implement the required process of the law, integrate it with our own ethics consultation process. Thought about why the ethics review committee is there as a mechanism to safeguard particular patients and not others. It safeguards dementia patients, nursing home residents, minors, but not patients alone. Why isn't the Ethics Review Committee given something to say about futility cases in a more formal way, or treatment refusals, or in disputes about prior wishes and surrogate versus surrogate opinion? I think that's the legacy of certain special interests. The law was 17 years in the making in New York State, actually, and sort of the legal legacy of the clear and convincing evidence standard, but we can talk more about that. There's also discordant, this is my last slide, my last content slide, I'm being given the... there's discordant requirements for Ethics Review Committee involvement in a hospital and nursing home. And that's when I talked about Category B patients, say, withholding a PEG tube or withholding dialysis. You don't need the Ethics Review Committee to be involved in that decision in the hospital, and it has significant implications for continuity of care across the continuum, where a decision could be implemented without that review in the hospital, and then maybe you want to do a time-limited trial of a PEG. You can't promise that family that they could withdraw the PEG later without Ethics Committee review. And I'll leave it there. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't play one on TV, but we have... Jack Schwartz in the audience, who's a great resource in Maryland, used to be in the Attorney General's office and is well-versed in this topic, and we're lucky to be able to work with him there. So we're going to just, it'll be, I think, interesting to compare New York to Maryland and then open for questions and just actually suggestions that you have for where we might go from here. So Maryland, the two related laws would be the Healthcare Decisions Act, and there's the full act is on this website, which I was told to read, but I'm not going to because it's too long, but just Google Maryland Attorney General's Office and you can find it under the health policy on the left. And the Patient Care Advisory Committee Act. The Healthcare Decisions Act was really in response to a case similar, not too dissimilar from the Terry Schiavo case of Ronald Mack, who was in an automobile accident in a vegetative state and in a long-term care facility for about 6 years before his wife, who would visit him regularly, someone commented to her, you know, have you ever thought about stopping his feedings? And she didn't think that that was possible. So she made this request. The parents disagreed, went to court, and the judge was very troubled by having to choose, you know, what was the right thing to do. And there, unlike the Schiavo case, there wasn't any evidence based on comments that he made of what he would have wanted. So shortly afterwards, the Maryland law came to be and established this hierarchy for decision making. Who's the surrogate if patients in persistent vegetative state, terminal or end-stage condition, and that's the guardian, spouse or now domestic partner, that's been more recent addition, is the domestic partner, then adult child, parent, adult sibling, and a close friend or relative who signs an affidavit. And the thinking is that you choose your spouse, you don't choose your parent, and parents might be more compelled to be in that role of protective role and not making decisions based on what you would have wanted. So if there's disagreement between individuals in the same class, then the law requires that this be referred to the PCAC or the Ethics Consultation Service or the Ethics Committee. PCAC is the Patient Care Advisory Committee, so that's the legal term. And that if a physician acts in accordance with the recommendation of the committee, there's immunity. There is similar, somewhat similar to New York, this requirement that in these instances, or for these particular cases, you have to have a physician and a nurse not involved in the care of that particular patient, a social worker, and then a CEO or other administrator, and then you can have whoever else you want to have. That doesn't mean every consult has to have all these people, but any consult where you want this immunity to kick in has to have these individuals involved. And the requirement also that advice is part of the patient's medical record. Now, the PCAC law requires that on the request of a petitioner that the PCAC will offer advice in cases involving individuals with life-threatening conditions, and again, similar to the Healthcare Decisions Act, when surrogates of equal decision-making priority disagree, the physician will refer the case to the PCAC. And then the PCAC is required to consult all members of the treatment team, the patient's family, and then if it's a case involving pediatrics and end-of-life care, a pediatric end-of-life care specialist. And it also spells out some of the process standards, such as basically a substituted judgment, what types of things the surrogate should take into account in order to make their decision about what the patient would have wanted. So the patient's expressed wishes, values, religious affiliation, other things like that, and that you shouldn't make judgments based on someone's prior disability. And then there's immunity for any advice given by the committee and its members in good faith, anyone assisting in the establishment of a committee, and that if the recommendation is inconsistent with a written institutional policy, then the physician doesn't have to follow that. It doesn't say how the committee should be run, the process the committee should follow in running its meetings and consults, and the need for meetings when not petitioned. So if you don't get any requests, you don't have to have a meeting every month or however often, which could be a problem if you're not used to, you know, the process of responding. This is just my attempt to kind of look at, what are the purposes of these laws and specifically related to end-of-life decision-making. And I was thinking, on one hand, from a legal perspective, the goal is really to free up the judges and courts, and in some cases guardians, from having to make these decisions when maybe they're not the most qualified, and so you're wasting the time of the courts that are already overburdened. On the far right, you would say that that could also be labeled, you know, that at the level of the patient, you want to do what's ethically right. And typically, you're worried about either mistakes in substituted judgment, in which the patient wouldn't have wanted to be cared for in this way, and the surrogate is making decisions not based on what the patient would have wanted. So you're, in a sense, harming the patient in that way by not following their wishes as we would best know them. The other would be, if you have no idea what the patient would have wanted, that the treatments that you're implementing are actually doing more harm than good. So this best interest standard is not being followed. And then the third would be that, you know, the process is fair. So that if there's an error in how we've come up with the substituted judgment or best interest, that there's an appeal process in place that would, you know, level the playing field and be fair. And I call these, that would be like the micro justice issue. The macro justice is at the level of the state. And in between is this idea that even though a lot of people that talk about, you know, specifically medical futility laws and policies say, oh, it has nothing to do with resource allocation. This is all about unnecessary patient suffering or not following patients' wishes. But that if you have a patient who is, we don't know what the patient would have wanted, and the family's saying, no, keep them alive, keep them alive, I want them alive, and they are palliated, so you're giving them, you know, morphine and other things that would keep them pain-free, it's difficult to make an argument that there's no consideration of resources. And I think that that's also one of the goals is to promote proper stewardship of scarce resources, not so much healthcare dollars, but the ICU beds and dialysis machines and ventilators and LVADs and that. And also to get support for a practice standard. And I'll talk about that more in a second. So where I think there's confusion is what is the role of this PCAC or the ethics committee that's reviewing these cases? And Thad went through some of these roles. I think that there are different skills and a different knowledge base for each of the roles, and I'll read them for the purposes of the recording. The adjudicator, you might need skills in appellate review, case neutrality, mediator, obviously mediation knowledge and skills. If you're called in as the ethics expert, certainly, then there's certain knowledge capacity competencies that you need to have. Surrogate decision maker, something that we don't see in Maryland as a use of the committee, but then certain facilitation skills and other ethics knowledge. And then this other category of is really the value of this committee, that they're representing a diverse sort of neutral jury model where you're getting people that don't necessarily have to have specific knowledge, but they have to be articulate and diverse so that they're presenting sort of a, various perspectives that might have been missed. So I think the challenges are that in addition to role ambiguity, that, you know, role expertise isn't guaranteed simply by belonging to the being a member of the ethics committee or the ethics consult service or even having a degree in ethics, since we know that the ethics programs aren't yet accredited, and so there's a lot of variation in how people are actually trained to do ethics consultation and clinical ethics. And then also this preference for a group model. So if we move forward with what some people call the professionalization of ethics consultation, that's really focused on the advanced level practitioner as an individual. How does that play out when these decisions are being made by a group? And how do you guarantee the competence of a group as opposed to the competence of an individual? So I think there's concerns related to lack of knowledge, lack of skills. So the knowledge piece is, again, not an issue if you're just going for that jury model. If you're just looking for people who, you know, represent sort of this average reasonable citizen perspective. And then the skills, avoiding authoritarianism and groupthink, and then this concern about process standards. So clarifying what the ethics issue is, what the role of the ethics consultant is, et cetera. So Maryland's approach has been one of the things we've done in Maryland. I didn't start it, but I am the program coordinator for the Maryland Healthcare Ethics Committee Network, which was developed in order to ensure that people on ethics committees are qualified. So we provide resources, we do conferences, we have a newsletter, and we provide a networking opportunity for people in the state. These are just some of our brochures for the conferences that we hold. And we recently had some concerns expressed by people in the state about medically ineffective treatment certifications that are allowed by the law. And we held a symposium and we gathered a lot of different players from the state. And in those discussions, some of the pros for the Maryland's Healthcare Decisions Act related specifically about medically ineffective, I think, is that the narrow definition of futility in the law is good because it protects against quality of life biases. Some institutions felt like it was working well. They were all on the same page, but others had some concerns. I'm going to go a little more quickly because of time, about certain terms being undefined and some being too prescribed, and then other issues related to transfer provisions. So this is an example. Ethically inappropriate is not defined. Medically ineffective treatment is defined as, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, a procedure will not prevent or reduce the deterioration of the health of an individual or prevent the impending death of an individual. And their concerns with the law are related to this provision, which I think came to be because of the lobbying interests when the law was written, that there were objections to this idea of taking away life support if it would result in hastening the person's death. So this provision that if you are going to not provide a treatment, you have to inform the surrogate, provide transfer, and then pending transfer, unlike Texas, there is no time limit. So if withholding or withdrawing the treatment would likely result in the death of the individual, you have to keep going. So there are differing interpretations of whether that applies to CPR attempts, et cetera. So there's discussions that we're having in the state about what the next steps are. And this is a great resource that Jack's written a lot of these advice letters on the Attorney General's website that provide some direction on interpreting the law. I'm going to just list these quickly because I think my time is almost up. Some of the problems about lack of skills and knowledge and diversity of opinions might be addressed by this ongoing issue of the competence of people, which we're talking about at the broader level at ASBH. You don't want to over-professionalize because you'll displace people who are those community members maybe and others that are around the bedside that are relevant to the discussion. But at the same time, we want to ensure that people have minimum competence. And the other big issue of if the big concern is taking doctors off the hook who aren't having those conversations about end-of-life care the way they need to be, and if the law will let them say, you know, I don't really need to be motivated to have those good conversations because I can just call in the ethics people and say, you know, this is futile therapy, then you're shifting the responsibility away from the physicians to either have those conversations or establish what standard of care is, which I think is another issue. There is a lack of consensus about what is the medical standard of care. And conflict of interest has been brought up as well about whether the institution might have a conflict. If they're making decisions by their ethics, if their ethics committee is making recommendations, typically in situations where the institution might serve to save money if you're not extending life for a patient that might be a high-cost patient. And some people have talked about having this idea of external review or maybe forming a central ethics committee that could look at cases like that outside of the institution for more protection against bias. So I think this is where we're thinking about next steps, and this is where we're going to elicit your suggestions and comments on where you think we need to go next. Thank you.
All right, thank you, everyone. Questions? Okay, I'm supposed to summarize the question. So you note a discord between the state law requirement of a full ethics committee review and the very practical real world situation where these cases are being reviewed either by an individual consultant or a team of consultants, but not the entire ethics committee. So, and what your question is, what should be the solution to that?
since the New York law says that disputes can be resolved by, quote, less formal means, we've just put our ethics consultation process in those, quote, less formal means. But I've been very conscious of the fact that that puts me in the position of deciding when the more formal mean is needed. Because people don't call at Montefiore and ask for an ethics review committee. They know about our consultation service. They don't know about the law as much. So the burden is on our service to know when to do this. And certainly for the cases where an ethics review committee would be binding, I'm thinking we'll do it. But we'll see. But I'm sort of living with the ambiguity okay.
I also think it depends on the role. And usually the ethics consultant that's on call isn't necessarily told this is an application of the law. So they get a consult and say, you know, this person's been in the ICU for 4 months and we think this is barbaric what we're doing. And then the consultant should be figuring out if they're doing it correctly, what needs to be done to address that ethics issue. And so I think you're right that there are instances where the consultant isn't appropriately calling in other people to get that diverse perspective. But if what's really needed is a facilitator to bring the family and the healthcare team together and clarify goals of care and that solves the problem, then you're not really going to the place where the law, resides. But I don't know if other people, this is a time for other people to weigh in. I think.
Hey, would people come up? All right. I feel like Oprah. I'm gonna alternate sides of the room to make sure everyone gets their shape.
Thank you. This question is specifically for Mr. Pope. So you recommended that we strengthen due process for a healthcare ethics committee, especially as they gain more legal authority. I was wondering if you could give some indication of how you envision that looking. And especially if there are other analogous bodies that do similar things to this that are already designated in the law in other settings.
I think this does link back into Jack's question a little bit because I think, again, it's going to depend on exactly what role the ethics committee is serving, you know, in a particular situation. But I think at least in a dispute resolution role, right, where ideally, right, if the individual consultant on the individual consultant level can resolve it, then there is no conflict anymore. It's been resolved, so you don't need to go to the ethics committee. So the ethics committee sits there in case the dispute is truly intractable. So what's analogous? What am I thinking of? Well, I think, for example, in a futility situation, there's lots of different types of futility situations, but it's often providers versus surrogates, right? And I think that physicians should give patients and surrogates what they give themselves. So one analog would be the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act, right? When there's peer review, right, when somebody's credentials and privileges are revoked or suspended or restricted in some way, the Healthcare Quality Improvement Act has a whole lot of due process mechanisms that are specified. And I think that the amount of notice that you get before you have to come and defend yourself and so forth. And so I think there are analogs like that you can look to think, well, why don't we have the same rigor of fairness, for ethics committee processes? And I could give you some more that I look to when I'm trying to figure out what exactly, you know, would be a fair process to pattern after.
I guess this is mostly to Anita. So you talked about the groupthink, like average people, and I serve on an ethics committee where it's anything but groupthink. We have our required New York State one unaffiliated member. She's an investment banker with a PhD in philosophy. She's our outside member. And everybody else is one shade or another of a health professional. So we have our lawyer and our clergy internal and the bioethicists. So there are 7 of us who are non-physicians and 18 physicians. And I think when you have a group such as ours, only one non-physician, you have a professional commitment to a set of values. So that makes it not just a groupthink of average people, but a groupthink of health professionals with values, commitments, standards, a long period of applying those values and principles to their decisions. So it's anything but average groupthink.
It sounds like you're doing it right. I think that I wasn't meant to imply that there's necessarily groupthink. I think there's the risk of groupthink that needs to be protected against, but that's not the only thing you want to worry about with that model is groupthink. There are other things that can go wrong with lack of knowledge or skills of the members in that group.
I think there's much more danger with the sole practitioner going to the bedside, because even if they've gone through some program, they can just be screwed.
Yes, I agree.
So this is for Hannah and Anita. So given all that you've presented, there's the underlying question is, so do you think that these laws actually are the right way to go in terms of addressing the problems for which they apparently are designed to address?
So I sort of have a very New York-y answer and then sort of a philosophical answer, but the New York-y answer is that if this is what it took to get our change from the clear and convincing evidence standard, that they would conceive of these ethics review committees as backstop protections for patients, then yes, I'm happy that we have it, because the old standards were really onerous for patients. It's a very practical sort of New York-y answer. I think that recognizing that there needs to be a process other than the court is the right way to go. I'm not for more concrete legislation than we have. I think it's probably too concrete, in my opinion, about ethics processes. I don't think that legislating ethics committees is going to raise the standards. I think that doing this from the ASBH point of view is a much better way to go. But we need methods other than court to resolve disputes. That's my personal opinion.
I think there's a role for the law, but I have conflicting feelings because I wouldn't suggest that they take away a law that's already in place just because there's a learning curve that goes on and people kind of improve things as they go along. But I wouldn't want to see the law legislate how people should be educated. So you get sort of into this, once you write the law, you have lawyers that interpret the law, and then you get into this difficult area where you're cornered by their interpretation of the law, which wasn't intended. And then physicians that, you know, you would like to think in an ideal world would just do the right thing and not have to be concerned about being protected by a law that gives them immunity in some cases. Couldn't you just do what's medically right? But that, again, is it would be nice if it worked that way, but it doesn't. So the people acknowledge when we had our symposium that these were really addressing these outlier cases, that what the law allows is for physicians basically to make decisions on behalf of surrogates who don't want to feel burdened by pulling the plug on their loved one, and that the physicians are too afraid of doing that just by themselves without the support of some kind of their community, and in this case, the law, and that those few cases where the families object, you do need to have a process to handle those cases. But I think we could discuss whether we think the law is the best way to handle the outlier cases or not.
This isn't the question I was going to ask, but I'll try to get my comment in and then the question. I strongly object to the statement that you all seem to have been making about not having community members and having mostly, or having almost all, people who are with the institution on the committee, which is what you said. I think that, sure, most of the people in the institution should be on, most of the committee should be people on the institution, but there's a value to having community members and lawyers who are not just the institution lawyers. So, I mean, that's just my statement. My question, very quickly, is the committees that you're talking about, or the institutions, the law that you're talking about, does that require that all of these cases come to the ethics committee? Or what if people don't, what if the physicians don't ask for an ethics committee consult? And if they don't, doesn't that seem to be a lack of due process for the patient?
Yeah, I'm Jack Schwartz, currently at the University of Maryland School of Law. Speaking only about Maryland, no, physicians are not required to, but they get the carrot of immunity if they do. So there's a fairly strong incentive.
Corey Perry, Ohio Health. I'm going to take the question in a little bit different direction because, you know, Thad talked about the role of the ethics committees earlier on in the 60s really being about allocation of scarce resources, and Anita, you had even mentioned in terms of, you know, these futility cases, it does become an issue of scarce resources and you know, how we're managing those. And we oftentimes think of kind of the ethics committee's role in really scarce resources and the role of the standard of care being in the times of pandemics and how the standard of care would potentially be altered and the role of the ethics committees and things at those points in time. But at least with our system, we're kind of facing that present reality in terms of chemotherapeutic shortages and how we actually begin to adjudicate which patients are getting access to, say, Taxol, 5-FU, some of the really common, frequently used chemotherapeutic agents, and our ethics committee is becoming more engaged in those deliberations. And are you aware of anything that's out there at this point in time to look to try to create some, you know, immunity, protection, empowerment for ethics committees around those determinations around scarce resources? Again, not getting out to the full-blown kind of pandemic realities, but even in these kind of current realities that we're facing now.
I think you're right, is that I guess what we've all focused on, the ethics committee serving in a clinical ethics consultation role, and they're also asked frequently to serve in an organizational role and in a triage role. I mean, so there are two or three or four other roles that ethics committees serve in, maybe even more appropriately than the ones we were talking about. And I think that's a real gap, right? And so if you look at the literature on triage, crisis standards of care and things like that, that in general, not just in the ethics committee context, there is not the promise of immunity to all the people who need immunity to be properly incentivized to do really what they need to do to provide the greatest benefit for the greatest number, which is the standard that we adopt in the crisis. So I think in general that immunity is not there, and I think that the public health people who write about this have been calling that out the last few years.
It's that same conundrum with scarce resources, that you really need to make those decisions at the level of the community, so state usually, and ethics committees are at the level of the institution. I personally think that we need to be more transparent about the need to make mindful decisions about how we allocate scarce resources, other than the fact that the ICU triage physician is the one that decides who gets the ICU bed and who gets the continuous dialysis machine. So in that case, yes, there are resource allocation decisions, but I think that we want to pretend like this has nothing to do with that, and I think that's wrong. I think we need to be more direct and transparent.
One more question or comment.
My question's a little different. And all of these laws and a lot of policies that often sound a lot like these laws in states that don't have them is that these laws and policies presuppose a degree of medical certainty that, in my experience, just isn't there. So even when I've invoked some of these policies, what I get from the doctor is, oh, my patient's not quite in that situation. And then I get into situations that are much harder. It's not the family versus the healthcare team. It's the doctor versus the doctor. And I have, you know, the intensivist who says, oh, we shouldn't keep doing this. This is awful. And then I've got the neurologist who says, peg, trach, and place, and wait 6 months and see what happens. And then the family's waiting for advice, and then they call me, well, what do we do? And for our unbefriended or unrepresented patients, we have a policy that says the ethics committee, well, we don't have the authority to make the decision, but we have to determine if the physician recommendation falls within the range of ethically acceptable options. And for these patients, it is within the ethically acceptable range of options to withdraw treatment or not to withdraw treatment. So in effect, we end up having to make a decision. And when I call our legal counsel, they're of absolutely no help.
because they both fall within the legal range of acceptable options as well. So what do we do? Help.
In 30 seconds or less. Just to the first part of your question, I think, you know, you raised the very important point about what the business of doing ethics at the bedside really is. And it's about, you know, navigating difficult decisions in a set of uncertainty and clarifying, you know, perspectives and goals and all of that stuff, which I think is one reason why the laws as they're set up, at least in New York, about, you know, this notion that the patient and family can come and make a presentation and we can sort of very sterilely debate ethics issues sort of misses a lot of what the business of doing ethics at the bedside actually is, which is why I'm glad that it's not more formalized than it is, because I don't want to be constrained from doing that very important, you know, mediation, communication, and support role. I don't have anything to say about the second part.
I would just say that it seems to me that because we've created this ICU setting where anything goes, that the price we're paying for that is exactly what you're saying. And until we as a society address that elephant in the room, then we're at the bedside stuck in that dilemma of what do you do when, although one speaker yesterday said physicians should really be describing what's probable, not what's possible, and I thought that was instructive. So some of it is how things are presented and described, but others, I think a lot of the problem is a societal problem, and nobody wants to go there, so we're kind of treading water, unfortunately.
I would just say real quick that if I heard the first part right, that maybe certain situations aren't recognized as constituting that situation, so they don't get referred to the Ethics Committee. And I think that to some degree that's being addressed in a number of systems by making the Ethics Consult mandatory. Right? They don't need to be invited or consulted. It's automatically triggered by being in the ICU for 72 hours or some other trigger like that. And so, you know, you don't need to wait for it to be recognized by the frontline provider as... Okay.
All right. We are out of time, but thank you all for coming. Thank you to our panelists, and we'll see you next year. Safe travels.
Make plans now to attend next year's American Society for Bioethics and Humanities annual meeting, coming up October 18th through 21st of 2012 in Washington, D.C. This is a production of Roland Recording.